Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This is like the boy who cried wolf situation. We can't keep playing politics with this issue and then expecting to be trusted when the going gets really tough. We've got to have a neutral, calm, fact-based, trusting conversation with Australians, and that's going to be, you know, the most important tool and asset that we have in confronting the challenges ahead.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Rory Medcalf, head of the National Security College here at the Australian National University. Today's podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. Today, we've got a very special episode. I'm joined by the Honourable Claire O'Neill MP, the Federal Member for Hotham, and the Minister for Home Affairs and Minister for Cyber Security. And of course, Minister O'Neill spoke very recently at the National Security College on her portfolio, but very specifically the issue of foreign interference. So it's a particular pleasure to be recording this longer conversation with you. Welcome to the podcast, Minister.
Rory, thanks so much for having me. And I'm a long-time listener of your podcast and big fan of the work you're doing at the National Security College. So it's great to be talking to you.
Well, that's a wonderful endorsement up front. And I think that's really reassuring for my team, because really the mission of this podcast is part of the wider mission of the college, which was to expand and deepen the Australian conversation and the international conversation on national security. And, of course, that goes directly to the work you do now as Minister for Home Affairs and Cybersecurity. So thank you very much. Look, what I'd like to do in this conversation is get into some of the really fundamental issues of security that you deal with now day to day, but also with a view to the long term as minister. But I actually want to begin on a slightly more personal note. I think in this podcast, when we have guests who now have senior leadership roles in national security, we often want to understand them, I guess,
sure.
And their thinking. Yeah. And I guess looking at your career in politics, but also before politics, whether it was in academia, in study, or whether it was in the work you were doing, particularly with the private sector over the years, we're really interested in understanding what got you interested both in politics and in security, because national security seems to be a kind of theme throughout a lot of your thinking.
Yeah, so absolutely.
A little bit about yourself, please.
Okay, my life story. Sure, let's go. So I think my interest in politics came from my family home, like most people. My parents weren't political in the sense that they were not members of political parties, but it was an intensely political household. My parents were both book publishers, and they published really relentlessly books about Australia, especially my dad. He published more than 1,000 titles in his life, and I think we worked out some vast majority of them actually had the word Australia in the title. He published about Australian sport, nature, about the outback, travel, history, politics, lots of really famous political biographies that were published sort of around the 60s, 70s, 80s. And so the kind of running conversation throughout my childhood was really about our country and what Australia was and what it could be and what its role was in the world. So I think when I was a teenager, like most young people, certainly in the world I operate in, I developed a sort of white hot rage about the state of the world. And the Labor Party answered a lot of questions for me about what was wrong. I've never felt the Labor Party's perfect in every single way, but I always have deeply believed that part of my purpose is to fight inequality in the world, and that's kind of the core purpose of the Labor Party. So I have a really strong belief coming into politics that it was really important for me to have done lots of things before I kind of embarked on a political career. And so for that reason, and just partly because that's how I like to live, I have done a lot of different things. I've lived overseas. I've lived in different parts of Australia. I've spent quite a lot of time in Aboriginal communities. I've worked on the New York Stock Exchange. I studied at Harvard for 2 years and did a lot of study here in Australia too. And I did spend a bit of time working in business. So I spent just under 4 years working at McKinsey, and through that got a kind of inside view of pretty much every major economic sector in Australia. And I just learned a staggering amount about how our economy functions. Like I knew a lot about the economy. I didn't understand anything about business. And I remember the first day I worked at McKinsey going behind the front desk for the first time, just looking around and seeing all these people and thinking, I don't know what these people do. And then, you know, having a four-year journey of kind of really understanding how business works and how it impacts on our country. So that's kind of how I've ended up where I am. And national security, as you say, has been a really big theme. When I think about my purpose now in politics, I think about my kids and the Australia that they will enjoy as adults. And the two things that I'm really confident we'll define that country how we respond to climate change and how we deal with our changing geopolitical circumstances. And today I get to work really squarely in that latter space, and it's you know, it's a huge privilege to be able to do so.
Look, thank you for that answer, and for, I guess, the personal revelations there about what's shaped your thinking. And I think it is important for those of us who work in the national security space to look at security in that much broader context. When you talk about the nation's future, you talk about equality. I think the connection between security and justice is often one that doesn't always come first to mind when we think about security. So thanks for, if you like, you know, widening the aperture from the start of the conversation. And we'll come back a little bit later on, particularly to the speech you gave at the National Press Club last year, where you talked about national security in a very long-term view, or a relatively long-term view, because I think that will inform, I think, a few of these thoughts. I do want to get back to Australia now, and back to that sense of community, because, of course, both the community that you represent in your electorate and the Australia you've got to know through all that broad experience is a very complex place. It's very layered. It's obviously very multicultural. And one of the messages that we've heard in a number of your speeches lately, including your speech recently at the National Security College, is about engaging the community in national security. So I'd love to hear a little more of your thinking about the link between security broadly defined and the Australian community.
Well, it's a really interesting question, and I would say if there's one thing that probably really differentiates the national security challenges that we've faced in the past and those we face in the future, it's probably around how integral Australians themselves will be in resolving the problems of the future. When I think about my portfolio, I have this really critical role in protecting the domestic security of Australians. And that challenge now is going to forever involve an integral kind of discussion and conversation and collaboration between our leaders and Australian citizens. And I think foreign interference is probably the best example of that. So because of technology, really, it's become very easy for foreign governments to reach into our country and try to shape our politics in ways that I fundamentally believe are illegitimate and wrong. We can't tackle that in government alone. We actually have to equip the community with the knowledge and the resources to see this problem occurring in their orbit and respond to it. So we can't have a conversation in Canberra here about national security and not ensure that it filters through into the households of people who will be our most important partners in having a safe Australia in 2030, 2040, 2050. So one thing I would say is, the most important thing about this discussion is not to politicize it.
Yeah.
And the reason that I say that is because Australians are really smart and they know when politicians are politicising matters and they stop listening. And we can't afford to have that happen. So I'm very committed to making sure that we have as bipartisan a conversation as we had, though that's not always possible, but most importantly, a kind of non-politicised conversation. And that means we've got to tell the truth and we've got to be honest with Australians about the type of challenges that we confront and what they look like and just really work to build that trust with the community back up again because we're going to need it in the years to come.
And that includes that full spectrum of security issues, whether it's foreign interference, mm-hmm. climate change, geopolitics, technology. I mean, you'd apply that across the board.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I mentioned foreign interference there, but cybersecurity is another one of my responsibilities and I'd just put that right there in this space as well. One of my big pushes is transparency and openness. One of the things I've been really surprised by since coming into my role is I consume vast amounts of intelligence, as you can imagine, in my position now. And you can't read these reports and think anything other than the Australian people have to know more about this, that they don't know enough about the context and the ways in which people are trying to interfere with our politics and our security. And so we've tried to open up the doors a little bit and I will really be pushing to continue to do that. Just a couple of examples, you know, we called out in the Medibank attack last year, the Russian hackers that were responsible for that attack. This week I talked openly about Iran as a driver of illegitimate foreign interference in Australia. I really want to keep doing that. It's important that we provide accountability and show people what's going on, but most importantly, that we just explain to Australians that there are big security issues in their orbit and I really want them to be aware of it so they can respond.
Thanks. And I think and the reason I say thanks is because that's a theme that's close to the heart of the work of the National Security College. We're very interested in looking at the changing nature of intelligence and the way in which, for example, open source intelligence now actually can help government really communicate.
Yeah.
You know, break that gap, as you say, between what you see in the confidential world and what the public understands.
Well, we have a really shared passion there in that case, Rory, and something that is really fascinating about this conversation is that it requires a huge cultural shift within our intelligence agencies who are, by their very nature, covert, you know, trying to keep secrets at all times. We need them to do something different and that is really open up. And Mike Burgess, the DG of security in Australia, has really led that conversation here. I think he's the first DG of security internationally to have his own Twitter profile, which probably sounds a bit twee, but it's actually not at all. We need to bring these problems out of the shadows and into the light. That's the only way we're going to be able to address them.
And I note that we're recording this, I think, before the release of his annual threat assessment, but by the time this recording is released, that may well be out.
Yep.
So we'll watch with interest. Let's move back to the private sector, if I may, because I think your insight there is to what it's like, if you like, behind the shop mm-hmm. front of whether it's big consulting firms or whether it's the boardrooms of Australia is incredibly important. I've often seen that disconnect between the national security conversation we have in Canberra and not only the priorities and imperatives of our commercial sector, but the way they think about the national interest. What's the best way, in your view, to engage the private sector on national security issues and how well are we doing?
Yeah. So, firstly, I just want to reiterate the point about trust. I think if I can just make one brief comment about some of the things I felt really troubled about under the previous government's approach to these issues, it was the reflex willingness to politicise national security issues and particularly to talk about China in a way that I felt was highly politicised. And then when you sit down in a boardroom and try to have a real discussion with people, the sense of coherence and trust between the parties just isn't there. And that's what I'm trying to sort of correct. We need to go back to a conversation which is really fact-based and in the national interest, not in the political interests of me or any other politician in this country. Information is key. And, you know, we sort of tear out our hair a little bit about national security challenges. Whenever I have had a conversation as Home Affairs Minister with an individual or organisation or group of Australians that alerts them to a national security risk, they care. Immediately. They immediately want to address the problem. But I think the question for government is, are we giving them the information and the tools that they need to do so? If I can just make one other point, I think, you know, it would be so wonderful if everything between business and government could be solved through good open conversation. It's not always the case. It's just not always the case. The imperatives just don't always line up. So, you know, good regulation is really important. And I just come again back to cybersecurity. So one thing I would say that the previous government did that was really good for our national security was the Security of Critical Infrastructure Act, which for those who are not familiar with this, is the way in which we are protecting critical infrastructure and assets around Australia. So if I can just explain a little bit to your listeners, because I think it's really interesting for people who are interested in national security. One of the big shifts in thinking that we've had to go through over the last probably decade is the recognition that particular industries or assets in Australia, whether they be privately or publicly owned, are integral to our national security interests, and therefore government has a right to engage with owners of those pieces of infrastructure to protect them, because that helps protect our country. So that sounds probably a bit like gobbledygook, but I'm talking here about things like the electricity grid, like major hospitals in our cities, where, you know, even things like, you know, supply chains and logistics, where if these things fail, even though they're in private ownership, there are huge national security implications. We can't feed the population. We can't give them medical care. We can't give them utilities. So the Security of Critical Infrastructure is a way that government has regulated for minimum standards across a range of different threats. And one of the most important of those is cyber. So under the Security of Critical Infrastructure Act, I now set minimum cyber standards for businesses in critical industries across Australia. Huge thing. I mean, it's a huge intervention of government into the world of commerce. Very necessary, because we were just not getting there through voluntary codes and good conversation. So I think we need to accept that despite the great willingness of businesses and industry and community to help us with these things, sometimes the law is going to be necessary.
I'm glad you've mentioned that, because later we'll talk a little bit about national resilience in that comprehensive sense. And also, I guess, although you make the point about the politicisation of national security over the years, particularly on the China issue, you also acknowledge that some of the settings, the policy settings that have been in place over the last few years, including from previous governments, are on the right track. I mean, it's a case that it looks to me as if your government is, I guess, refining and strengthening some of those settings rather than introducing them. What's your sense?
I think it's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. Certainly, I would never, you know, come into office saying that everything that happened in the last 10 years was a complete disaster. Of course, some really important and good things happened. And indeed, the former government was in power during a big shift in our geopolitical circumstances. Think about the difference in the national security conversation between when they were elected in 2013 and where we are now in 2023. You couldn't have imagined that things could change so quickly in a decade. And I think there were some important things that were done, but I really want people to understand politicisation of these issues is dangerous. It reduces the government's ability to help protect Australians. And if I can pick one thing that will change under the new government in Australia, it is that we're here for the national interest, and these things are too important to be toyed with. We can't do anything that reduces government's power to solve these problems with the population.
I think that point's well taken, and I think across the spectrum, for example, the work the college is now seeking to do with our program of briefings for parliamentarians across the political spectrum, I hope that can be reinforced. Mm. But let's turn to the future. And I think your speech in December, taking a long view for Home Affairs, is one marker. But of course, you're not new to thinking about the future long term. And there's a book that you co-authored with Tim Watts, I think, in 2015, called Two Futures: Australia at a Critical Moment. And that book is something that, in fact, full confession, we set it as reading for our students back then when it was released.
Nice.
but of course, the world changes, and I think any of us who seek to, if not be futurists, then at least recognise the importance of structured thinking about the future. The first thing we acknowledge is that you can't predict
exactly
the future. You can, you know, analyse, project, look at plausible futures. Your book looked to 2040 and looked at the choices Australia had to make, in your view, in order to achieve that sustainable, just, secure future that you're talking about. A lot's changed since 2015, as you said, since your book was published. Any confessions there on what changes you didn't anticipate, or what changes perhaps, you know, unfortunately, you got right.
Yeah. The way that you've talked about the approach to the future is very much how Tim and I thought about writing this book, and that is that, you know, any attempt to predict the future is basically crazy and it can't be done. And there's, you know, every example you look at where people have just made mad predictions, very smart people that haven't come to fruition. What we tried to do instead was think about the six things we thought would drive the quality of life of Australians in 2040 and just think generally about those subjects. And I would say that it's held up very well, really because of the approach, not because Tim and I are so clever. But if you think about, you know, obviously climate, inequality, you know, the way that we've gone through this period of really difficult sort of economic stagnation, these things have all been, I think, proved accurate. The two things I would just draw out, as I said before, no one, I don't think, could have predicted how different the geopolitical circumstances are for us and even how we define the national risks, national security risks facing the country. If you think back to when we wrote that book in 2014, you know, one of the big conversations was about sub-state actors as the new kind of drivers of national security. Well, we're back into, you know, big power diplomacy in a way that, you know, could yeah. never have been anticipated, really. And when I think about the national security conversation I observed in the parliament through that period, I mean, we were going through really difficult counterterrorism issues. We had Syria on the go. We had a lot of foreign fighters leaving Australia and returning under various different circumstances. It was just a very different time. And the subtext of all of this was a benign China. And of course, that's changed so quickly in that 10 years. You know, things have just really dramatically shifted on that front. So I would say the national security, I mean, nothing in it is wrong, I would say, but it's just, it looks a little bit different and I think more dangerous than we had anticipated it would be. The other one I'd just point to is Tim and I have a great passion for Australian democracy and a deep concern about the way in which Australians are gradually losing trust in their democracy. That, for me, is one of the most important national security challenges that we face. There are deliberate attempts around the world to degrade the quality of democracy in democratic countries by authoritarian regimes who are trying to reduce our degrees of freedom to respond to global events, trying to make us feel that democracy doesn't work, that it's fundamentally not the right system of government, that democracies can't be trusted to engage in conflict, those sorts of things. These are very, very dangerous ideas. And so, something I'm very passionate about in my role is actually trying to fight back against this. This is, you know, the quality of democracy around the world is a much admired problem. Everyone can speak with great detail about the contours and shapes of it, but no one, I don't think, is doing much about it. And I would like Australia to lead the way on that. So that's a project that we're starting in Home Affairs this year.
So if you like what you're thinking and writing at that stage of your career and the challenges you're grappling with in a leadership role now, you can see those continuities. And I think there's a message there too, which really I'd share for any analyst, whether they're in government or the intelligence community or the private sector, if you've got that that judgment about some major change or discontinuity coming in the strategic landscape, don't be shy in sharing it, because I think even on the China issue there, you know, there were voices, as I can tell, who were looking at these plausible futures, but they weren't necessarily getting traction, including within government. And I think it could well be now that there are voices thinking about the changes 10 years, 15 years from now, who at this stage may, you know, may struggle against groupthink.
Yep.
So I'd also take your remarks, Minister, as a kind of, if I can interpret it that way, as an admonition to say that we should never stick with the groupthink at the moment. We should always be looking at the plausible breaks.
Absolutely, Rory. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I guess one of the messages here is it's really important for politicians to be reading and speaking to a wide range of people. And I actually do go to quite a lot of efforts to find people who are well-informed on subjects but do have a different view than me, to just really more to test my own thinking and have the argument and see, you know, what comes out of it. Rory, can I just come back to what we've just talked about there, the changing shape of the national security conversation over a decade, because this is very important and pivotal to the way in which I'm embracing the home affairs portfolio. So my department was created by Peter Dutton only 5 years ago, and it was created very much in the sort of context of the things that Peter Dutton stands for in politics. And I say that without any critique, it's just who he is as a person. And so the discussion about home affairs at the time was very much around boats and managing the borders, around crime types that he's particularly interested in, around drug trafficking, these sorts of matters, very important things for the country and very important national security risks we face. What I would say is that I think it's a much too narrow lens of domestic security for us. And the big change that I'm trying to push in home affairs is all of these big geopolitical challenges that we face, the most dangerous ones that we've faced, that Australia's faced since the Second World War. This is a big national security challenge for the country now. This has huge domestic security implications that home affairs wasn't designed to be addressing. And one of the things that my secretary, Mike Pizzullo, and I are working on is how do we restructure the work of this department to tackle the real challenges here? And that is around foreign interference, around democracy, national resilience, and cybersecurity, to name a small handful. The department will still focus on all of the other things that it was doing before because those are really important, but it's really saying, you know, let's think about what domestic security means for us in this very, very difficult period that we're about to enter as a country. And my view is that Home Affairs does need to change quite a bit its work to address those concerns.
And that goes to a theme I was actually hoping to get to at the end of the conversation, but let's go to it now, which is what is the future for the Department of Home Affairs and the portfolio? Because obviously some changes have already been apparent since the change of government. Obviously the Australian Federal Police essentially going back under the Attorney General. And I'm not talking only about machinery of government changes here, but also, as you say, changes in culture or changes in focus. Is there any more fidelity you can give to that that vision for how the department and the portfolio will evolve in meeting these challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I've given you a little bit of a big picture of it there, but just to be more specific. So one of the changes that the government made was to create a cabinet minister with responsibility for cybersecurity for the first time in Australian history, and they gave that position to me also. And I think that's in recognition of the fact that cyber is at the heart of all of the national security challenges that we face. Every single one of them has a cyber dimension to it, and that problem wasn't being managed particularly well before. I would say we're probably 10 years behind where we need to be on cybersecurity as a country, and we've got to push really fast to get ourselves in order. And so we are doing significantly more in home affairs on cybersecurity and trying to bring some coordination and spine to the work that's happening around the Australian government on that matter. I talked a little bit about foreign interference. This is a huge feature of our work now because this is relentless, egregious, happening in every community every day, and the size of the public discussion and the government response isn't anywhere near the size of the problem itself. So we're going to need to really step up our efforts there. And there's a few things I can talk about that the government's already doing there. The other things that are important and new work for the department are around national resilience. So this is a project that says we actually know a lot about the national security context that we're facing into. I haven't seen the Australian government have a serious crack at articulating the domestic implications of what those national security risks are. So that's a project that we're undertaking at the moment. I think it's going to end up with some really important decisions. And then finally, I mentioned the work earlier on democracy. We are not going to be able to manage the national security risks that we face over the coming three decades, say, without making sure that we've got a functioning working democracy. And in many instances, that project is about trying to highlight that we actually do have a very functional democracy. In fact, when I travel around the world and talk to Home Affairs ministers in other countries, they are greatly envious of having a parliament that can actually work together and pass laws when it's in the national interest. And we certainly don't see that in every country in the world. But we do need to do a lot more to rebuild trust with the Australian electorate. And that's something that I see as part of the work of my department.
We'll be right back.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live.
From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
These ambitions and these themes, some of these were illuminated in your speech at the end of last year at the Press Club on the long view. And you spoke then actually about the Strengthening Democracy Task Force and the National Resilience Task Force, two initiatives that go precisely to what you said. We've not heard a lot about those since then. I know only a few months have passed and it's been the Australian summer and all of that. Mm-hmm. But I think there is an appetite to know more about those two task forces. So what's the plan?
Well, they're brand new pieces of work in the department. So the plan at the moment is to set them up properly and resource them and then lay out a plan of work for the year to come. And they're doing two very difficult and amorphous pieces of work for the Australian government. So it is going to take a little bit of time. Ultimately, the goal of these two new divisions effectively within Home Affairs are to provide the nation with a clear picture of the domestic security implications of our geopolitical context. What that means in plain English, lots of things are changing in the world. We've got pretty good information about what the big shifts are going to be over the coming decade at least. What will that mean for Australia? What risks will that pose for the country, and how can we plan for them and address them now? And really it comes back to this discussion we were having before, Rory, about the use of intelligence. Mm. We've got all this information, but the Australian government hasn't sat down and said, what is this going to mean for our citizens and how are we going to protect them when it happens? And that's the work of the national resilience piece. Then on democracy, this is a hugely difficult project because, as I say, this is a problem in every democratic country in the world, and I don't think anyone's found the answer. I believe Australia can lead this conversation because we've been doing that for 120 years. We're the sixth oldest democracy in the world. We are, you know, historically a huge innovator in democratic reform, compulsory voting, early female franchise, secret ballots, all of these things. You know, many of them were invented in Australia, or Australia was the first country, one of the first countries to implement them. We've kind of stopped innovating on that front, and I think there's space for us to be a world leader again on this. And so the work of the department is trying to understand a bit more about why democracy is in decline in Australia, and then quickly go to concrete actions that we can undertake to fight back, because it should jolt all of us that we all know democracy is pivotal and important. We all know democracy is in pretty steep decline, and yet no one's really doing anything about it, and we've really got to change that.
Am I right in thinking this won't only be work within the department as well? This will be about engaging voices externally.
Absolutely.
Building a kind of league of champions nationally on democracy and resilience.
Mm. That's exactly right. Yep, we're not going to solve democracy in the Home Affairs Department, Rory.
Much as
got
I respect,
to be a collaboration on that one.
I
think
respect,
yeah.
Australia's public servants, but I think that's sort of a key message to understand, because
Absolutely.
Also one challenge for us at the college is expanding our engagement with states and territories, mm-hmm. for example, mm-hmm. Where so much democracy happens. Look, let's now go back to the theme of, if you like, preparing for the future. And mm-hmm. I think both in your speech at the Press Club and, of course, a deeper theme of your earlier work and I think peppered throughout our conversation just now is that idea of preparing the nation for a difficult future. I mean, obviously great potential to achieve the Australia you want to see, but a lot of that is about getting through shocks and challenges mm-hmm. that are not of our making. My sense is that shocks lie ahead for Australia. We don't know exactly what or when, but if you look at geopolitics, if you look whether it's at the impact of China as an assertive power or geopolitics more broadly, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and that aggression, the pervasive threats from climate change, pandemic, you know, we've had this terrible shock in recent years. There's such a wide horizon of risk there, and how and when these shocks occur and how they intersect and cascade means, you know, with all that complex uncertainty, that we have to be prepared. So what, in your view, more needs to be done by government and by the broader nation, whether it's states and territories mm-hmm. or business or civil society, to prepare for strategic shocks mm-hmm. in the future?
Yeah. So what a great question. And very much, I think, the themes that you've picked up there, I just completely agree with. So if you're taking anything from this conversation, it's about having good information about the future, sharing it with the people who need to know it, preparing for risks and shocks and being able to recover quickly afterwards. And this is a sort of spectrum of you know, a cycle that we're going to have to continue to go through. And shocks is a good way to sort of catch it all, because when I think about the national security risk facing Australia, I've talked a lot about the geopolitical context today, but don't forget about climate change. This is a huge weakness in our system that we need to plan for and understand and respond to. So something that probably hasn't got a lot of play in the national security world is the changes that have been made within Home Affairs around emergency management. Mm-hmm. We have consolidated the emergency management tasks across government into Home Affairs. And the purpose for doing that is because I think there's a recognition that there's going to continue to be disasters of various kinds, whether, you know, climate-induced or man-made. And part of national resilience is being able to get up off the mat really quickly after something goes wrong. So we've set that up, and I think it's working really well to have all these engagements in one place. Cyber is one where I'm doing a lot of work and thinking at the moment. I dealt with the Medibank and Optus incidents last year. Those were, you know, principally commercial issues, but obviously had wide-ranging impacts for Australians themselves. It was the beginning of our cyber issues as Australians, not the end of them. And one of the things I really observed was that the Australian government was not set up for a wide-scale cyber attack that was going to impact millions of citizens. And we know that that's going to keep going, I hope not frequently, and I hope that we're better prepared next time, but we're not going to reduce our cyber risk to zero. That's not possible. So thinking about how we manage across government and governments the cleanup of cyber incidents is something that we're doing a lot of work and thinking on at the moment. So that shares a little bit of work, but I think the general themes that you've picked up on there around resilience and recovery are really important.
Can I just extend that that thought about emergency management into, I guess, broader crisis management? Mm-hmm. So one question that a number of us ask in the debate these days in Australia is, how prepared would we be for strategic shocks that are geopolitical in the region? So whether it's not necessarily war, but it could be military confrontation or deeply coercive confrontation in the region. I mean, there are many scenarios, mm-hmm. you know, Taiwan, East China Sea, South China Sea. Mm-hmm. There's a long list of things that could happen. And, of course, this would, whether Australia was involved directly or not, these things would have presumably a very deep and immediate impact on the economy, on society, on mm-hmm. national resilience. How do you see the mission for Home Affairs in that in that regard?
Yeah, well, I see it as central, and this is pivotal to the way in which we're trying to reshape the department, because when the crisis comes, Home Affairs is going to play a key role in the domestic implications. We've got, you know, the Defence Department and Richard Marles doing a brilliant job helping reshape our defence force to cope with the sort of risks that you're talking about. We've got Penny Wong out there on the global stage trying to prevent these things from happening. My job is thinking about the domestic implications for Australians should these things happen. And one of the, I think, surprises that I had coming into this portfolio was that that was not already part of the work of Home Affairs, because for me that's just so logical. We're about domestic security and these are domestic security risks. So the national resilience work that we just touched on before, that's the point of this piece of work in the department. It's thinking about what those futures look like, what the domestic security implications would be for Australians, and how we're going to prepare for those events and clean up the consequences if and when they occur.
So we could expect more work in this space and some pretty frank conversations with industry and society as time passes.
Yep, exactly. And Rory, just, you know, tapping back into one of the themes that we've covered this morning, we know a lot about what this future looks like. Maybe not the exact specifics, but the general shape of the challenges to come. We haven't been using that information as well as I would like to drive preparedness in the Australian government for those events, and that's something we're trying to change.
Look, thank you, Minister. I think that's a really important part of the national conversation. But before we wrap up, I want to touch again briefly on the speech you gave recently at the National Security College on Foreign Interference. We're recording this conversation mid February, and that speech was, identifying a new way of engaging with the foreign interference threat, which looked much more community focused, as far as I could tell. And you talked, I think you used an example or a number of examples of Iranian interference in Australia and how that was being met and resisted by government. But you also spoke about, what we might expect from communities, how to engage diaspora communities. It would be useful just to hear any further thought on that.
For sure. Foreign interference is one of the most substantial national security risks that we face. It is relentless and it's everywhere in the Australian community, and the Australian government needs to work much more closely with Australian communities to tackle it, because government alone isn't going to be able to solve this problem. It's got to be a really integrated partnership between government and diaspora communities in particular. We talked a little bit about how we think about diaspora communities in this context, and it's really important for diaspora communities around the country to see that we want to help and protect them. They are victims of what is an illegitimate attempt by foreign governments to try to control the politics in their communities, control their behaviour, and intimidate them, including doing things like watching them, following them, researching them, getting all sorts of information about them, harassing members of family back home, even, violence and putting people in jail, all these sorts of things. It's real. It's everywhere. So we're not going to be able to sort that out without those communities believing that the Australian government is there to help them and protect them, because the Australian promise is that you live a free and fair life in this country, and they're not getting that if foreign interference is allowed to flourish. So for the first time, I've asked my agencies, ASIO and Home Affairs, to develop a proper process of trying to educate people who might be targets of foreign interference about this problem. And as I said before, when I talk to Australians about this issue, they're very exercised about it, but they say to me, "We don't really know what this looks like. We don't know how to tackle it. We don't know what to do if we see it." And that's a role government's got to, that's a void government's got to fill. So part of the work of these agencies, which are typically not necessarily engaging with community every day, is to kind of open the doors a bit and really, really go out there and talk to people about how we can help try and protect them. And it's going to be critical to get that system working, because when we look outside Australia and everything that's happening in the world, we know that that problem in particular is going to get a lot worse as the decades progress.
And I take it that this applies to diaspora communities from all backgrounds. I mean, in a sense, the China challenge has been front of mind for many of us when we think about foreign interference in this country. And as you said previously, it's still there. It's very much still there.
Absolutely.
But if any community is excluded from that assurance and protection by the Australian government, they're essentially being treated as second class Australians. So we take it you're talking many, many backgrounds here.
Yeah, I think one of the flaws in the previous conversation was that the sense was this was only coming from one country, and that's just absolutely incorrect and not true at all. And I think, that impression was given probably for pretty political reasons. Again, this is like the boy who cried wolf situation. We can't keep playing politics with this issue and then expecting to be trusted when the going gets really tough. We've got to have a neutral, calm, fact-based, trusting conversation with Australians, and that's going to be, you know, the most important tool and asset that we have in confronting the challenges ahead.
Look, my final question is about another threat, which we haven't talked so much about today, but I know is day-to-day vital work for your portfolio, which, of course, is countering terrorism.
Yeah.
And violent extremism, politically motivated violence. We've had a particularly horrific incident in Queensland recently, which has now been defined by the Queensland police as religiously motivated terrorism. The killings of two police officers and a civilian. What, in your view, is the place of countering terrorism and violent extremism in the mission of your portfolio and your government? And how are you looking at defining the breadth of that challenge? Because, of course, the kind of violent extremism focused on Islamism in previous years hasn't gone away, but there seems to be now a much broader threat.
Yeah, great question. Terrorism's always going to be absolutely central to the work of the Home Affairs Department. And the reason for that is a lot of the problems that we talked about today are deeply challenging for the country. They're not an imminent threat to the life of Australians. And of course, threats to life are always the first priority of my department and of the Australian government. The incident in Queensland is a really watershed moment for CT in this country. It demonstrated a lot of ways in which the terrorism threat has reshaped. So obviously you mentioned, you know, that there's been a big focus in this discussion, quite rightly, on Islamic fundamentalism. That has changed. And when you talk to ASIO today, you know, their list of people that they're most concerned about, usually about half of the people on that list now are from a proliferation of ideologies, including Nazism, you know, white nationalist, fascist ideologies, people who are drawing from, you know, what they call a salad bar of radicalism, where there's a kind of whole bunch of different conspiracy theories being put together in various ways. So that's one of the issues. We've got a number of other big things being reshaped in that space though as well. There is a very large number of minors in the caseload at the moment, which is hugely concerning.
Terrifying.
We're talking about children who are 12, 13, 14, who are, you know, looking on the internet, who are, you know, learning about radical ideologies and also the techniques. And this is of great concern, should be of great concern to all Australians. Something else that we're seeing is if you go back to the kind of 2013, 14, 15, the way in which terrorism was presenting was, you know, big, expensive, maximum fatality, long-term planned events. And what they, what the experts explain now is that there is a short flash to bang. So basically someone will become radicalized and then move from a willingness to commit violence to committing violence in a terrifyingly short period of time. And this obviously creates huge issues in public safety, because how do we find that person and intervene when there's just not much time to do it? And the final thing I just want to mention is the lower technology attacks. So, Rory, you would have tracked the conversation about how ISIS kind of reshaped the terrorist formula to, you know, people going from, you know, people doing these kind of elaborately planned terrorist attacks to someone picking up a knife and stabbing someone in the street that can, you know, very difficult to detect. So this is a very different type of problem to the one that we saw around 2012, 2013, 2014 or the years preceding that. And I think that the big question for the Australian government now is the apparatus that we built for that earlier problem fit for purpose for what's happening now? And one of the things we absolutely know is that there's many more potential people that we could see potentially committing terrorist acts, and they're harder to track and find. So how do we think about reshaping the way that we deal with this problem to make sure that we're adapting to those circumstances?
Minister, thanks for sharing so many of those very direct insights into the, I guess, the great challenges that you and the government and the Home Affairs portfolio have in protecting the national interest, our values and identity now and into the future. Thanks for joining us on this podcast with the National Security College, and we look forward to engaging with you again.
It's been great to chat, Rory. Really appreciate your time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.